CHD3 Detroit, KMPS HD3 Seattle, WBMX HD3 Boston,
and on AOL Radio
and Yahoo Launchcast.
CBS Radio's The New Sky.
New horizons.
No boundaries.
Welcome to Hot Leads and Cold Cases with Nancy DuTetra.
Oh, mama, I can hear you a-crying. You're so scared and all alone. Hangman is coming down from the gallows.
Call Nancy DuTetra now.
248-545-SOUL.
Welcome, everybody. As soon as I contacted tonight's guest, Mitch Horowitz, to see if he would be available to be my guest on Hot Leads Cold Cases, I realized he actually looked very familiar to me, and I couldn't figure out why. And then I realized that he and I had both been guests on a television show called Love, Lust, and the Paranormal. I remember when I saw the first airing of that show, and I was wondering who that fellow was who seemed to know everything about the history of the occult movement in America. Well, I found him, and tonight he's my guest. Mitch is the author of a very informative book called Occult America, in which he explores the roots of today's fascination with everything paranormal. Mitch has become the go-to guy for anything having to do with the history and background of today's New Age and occult movements. He's written articles on spiritual topics for publications like The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, U.S. News and World Report, The Huffington Post, and many other prestigious journals. He's also a frequent guest commentator on television and radio, including shows like CBS Sunday Morning, Dateline NBC, The History Channel, and NPR's All Things Considered. So welcome, Mitch.
Thank you so much, Nancy. Glad to be here.
Absolutely. I would like to ask you, before we really talk about some of the very interesting things that you have in your book, Occult America, I'm sort of interested and curious to know, was there a need for this book? In other words, has anybody really ever talked about the history of the occult movement in the United States before?
Whenever people talk about the occult and its history in the United States, it's very often done in a sensationalistic way. You know, people write about satanic worship scares, or people want to talk about scary Ouija board stories, and I'm up for talking about all of those things. But occult and esoteric spiritual movements have been such a core influence on the religious development of our nation that I felt there needed to be a book that treated occult and alternative spiritual movements like a real part of America's religious history. These movements need to be understood as a part of the nation's spiritual development, whether it has to do with positive thinking, mysticism, or the various ways that people pursue occult practices, from channeling to astrology to tarot. Mainstream folks are often surprised how deeply the influences from paranormal movements have touched our traditional religious culture. And it was time that the occult had a place at the table in terms of understanding its real influence historically in America. So I felt there was a great need for the book, and that's what drove me to write it.
Interesting. Now, I think there's so few people in this field of the paranormal who are actually verbal. And I guess the fact that you also happen to be the editor-in-chief of one of the major publishing houses in the country might make you more prone to being verbal or being able to describe things. Did you find that was it something that was lacking in the history of the paranormal, that people could explain what it is in words?
Absolutely. People within the New Age spiritual culture, they're interested in healing, they're interested in experiences, they're interested in participation. And as a result, there tends to be an ahistorical quality within that culture. You know, you can have a conversation with somebody about tarot cards, but nobody really has a good bead on where this comes from. You can talk to somebody about the law of attraction, but very few people have any sense, where did that idea come from? And the truth is, in many instances, these things are a lot newer than we expect. Things that we call ancient traditions or old traditions are a lot more recent than we might gather. America is terrific at minting new religions. Yeah. We have all kinds of new religious movements in this country. Mormonism, Christian Science, Seventh-day Adventism. And in fact, the positive thinking approach, the motivational thinking that underscores our entire self-help culture and all the vast numbers of business motivational bestsellers out there, those ideas come out of American mystical movements from the 1830s, 1840s. Everything that seems old in America usually is a lot more recent than we think. So within these subcultures, there's a big emphasis on self-help, on therapy, not a big emphasis on history. And to really know ourselves, we have to know where we come from. So that's that was the jumping-off point for me for my recent work.
Well, and speaking of your jumping-off point, I have to ask you, I mean, what's your are you psychic?
I'm not psychic, no. But you know, a lot of people do ask me, are you a believer? And that's a very fair question, because when you're approaching a spiritual topic, people want to know, where are you coming from?
Absolutely.
And the answer is yes, I am a believer. I'm a critical believer. I'm a skeptical believer. But when it comes to a phenomenon like channeling, for example, I publish channelers. I work with channelers. I've visited channelers. The best folks within the channeling world, I think, have something very genuine and real to offer. I can't explain precisely what faculty is going on that produces the psychological or ethical messages that come through them. But I can tell you for a fact, it is as potent in many respects as what people experience when they're lying on the therapist's couch, and sometimes more so. So I spend a lot of my time criticizing and voicing skepticism about people who are overly credulous. I don't want people who are ardent believers. I don't think that leads to a deepened question or a sustained question, spiritually or ethically. But I am a believing historian.
I'm totally with you on that. I agree. You have to be, to some degree, questioning. And to me, that's what the word skeptical is all about. It's not about automatically dismissing something.
Yes. And, you know, of our new religious movements in this country, some of the finest historical writing that has come out of new religious movements has come from people within those movements. For example, Robert Peel is one of the great biographers of Mary Baker Eddy, the founder of Christian Science. He was that movement's archivist for many years. There's a very renowned historian named Richard Lyman Bushman who wrote an important biography of Joseph Smith, the Mormon prophet. Bushman is a Mormon believer. But these are also people with deeply critical minds as well. And that's what I'm hoping to try to do for the New Age.
Well, speaking of religions, let me ask you this. A lot of these newer religions that sort of took hold in the United States, and you talk about a bunch of them in your book, but the Quakers, the Shakers, the Seventh-day Adventists, the Mormons, to what degree are they rooted in what we would call today the occult?
That's a wonderful question. The occult is a term that came into use during the Renaissance. It was a way of describing the ancient and, in some regards, lost spirituality that had belonged to the worlds of ancient Greece, ancient Rome, ancient Egypt. The term occult came from the Latin occultus. It simply meant hidden or secret. And occult spirituality in the Renaissance mind came to mean a spirituality that was rooted in individual experience that very often was practiced outside of the parameters of any accepted doctrine or congregation. So you have a lot of movements that flowed into this country. In fact, back in America's colonial days, even as early as the 1600s, who were fleeing persecution in Europe, and they called themselves by different names. The Shakers, for example, we think of as a movement that organized itself into these tidy, neat little villages that put a big emphasis on craftsmanship and so on. The Shakers were accused of sorcery in England, a place which they fled in the 1700s. The Shakers were accused of witchcraft, of seances, of consorting with demons and spirits and talking to the dead. And the Shakers would say, yes, we do all of that, but it's not witchcraft. It's a search. It's real spiritual practice. We are trying to part the veil. And so the Shakers, who are not thought of as an occult movement, were, in fact, engaging in some very radical methods outside of anything that was accepted back in the old world. They fled the old world, came to New York State in 1775, and they really grew as an American movement. So there were lots of folks that were outside the fold that were drawing upon all kinds of spiritual methods that were not accepted. Freemasonry is another good example. They're not a religion, but they were a movement and remain a movement with a spiritual mission. They believe that individuals can draw upon ancient symbols, sometimes occult and esoteric symbols, for inner ethical development. Freemasonry was another group that aroused a lot of suspicion and distrust, especially among church authorities in Europe. That organization flowed to the American colonies, absolutely took root here, had a tremendous effect on the founding of the country. So there's all kinds of these different movements that exist outside the fold, that are offbeat, that were experiencing persecution in the old world, but were able to come to the new world, and their methods might have been called occult at one time or another. They selected their own names and labels, and they became part of mainstream life.
Terrific. We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to talk to you a little bit about Mormonism and the occult, because it's kind of a hot topic right now.
Yes.
And we'll be right back. You're listening to Hot Leads.
New Sky Radio. NewSkyRadio.com and Psychic Radio, PsychicOnAir.com. Powered by CBS Radio, AOL, and Yahoo is unlike any talk radio station. With a mission to improve the world, one listener at a time. This is where you can be the star of your own show. Our listeners are truly unique, truly interactive, and passionate about their world. The Sky and Psychic Radio listeners genuinely care about the environment, social justice, their personal health, and raising people up to live their best life every day. Our motto is New Horizons, No Boundaries. New Age views, life coaching, psychic analysis, alternative medicine, and cutting-edge mind, body, and spirit shows can all be found on The Sky and Psychic Radio. Perhaps you have what it takes to join our broadcast family, an open mind, a great idea, and a passion for enriching lives. Check out all the exciting details by clicking the microphone on our homepage at newskyradio.com or give Lisa Rodman a call at 248-546-9600 to learn just how affordable it can be to host a show.
Are you looking for a great gift idea for someone interested in the paranormal? Then listen up, because we've got the perfect solution for you. Author and psychic detective Nancy Dutetra has just published a groundbreaking new book entitled Psychic Intuition. This book is unlike any other on the market today. It explains how psychic ability works in simple scientific and layman's terms and uses examples from Nancy's own life as a psychic detective and medium. The book explores all those thorny questions skeptics always ask and no one ever has an answer for, like, why are women more intuitive than men? Is there such a thing as a sixth sense? Are psychics really just psychotic? How do psychic detectives get their information? What does it feel like to be touched by a ghost? What are the psychic senses and how do they work? Why won't science investigate this field? The book answers these and many more questions. Psychic Intuition is available on Amazon in paperback and Kindle format, and also on Nancy's website, www.theskepticalpsychic.com. Buy it today.
CBS Radio, The Sky, and NewSkyRadio.com are presented only for entertainment purposes and will not be liable or accept liability for any loss or damage of whatever nature which may result from advice or information offered.
CBS Radio's The New Sky. The Sky.
We're back. This is Hot Leads and Cold Cases with Nancy Dutertra. Nancy Dutertra now.
248-545-7685. Believe.
Okay, welcome back. We are talking with my guest tonight, Mitch Horowitz. And what I wanted to ask you, Mitch, was we were talking before the break a little bit about the different types of religions, which a lot of them fled from places in Europe because they were being persecuted there. They came here, they had occult overtones, and they sort of developed into this hotbed, which you say was something called the Burned Over District in upstate New York.
Yes, it was an extraordinary influential place in American history, and very few people have heard of it. The Burned Over District is sort of a snaking stretch of farmland that runs through central New York State from the city of Albany in the east to the city of Buffalo in the west. And for the early decades of the 1800s, it was called the Burned Over District because it was considered burned over with religious passion. Every new religion, every new religious movement, and many radical social movements that grew up in America came from that one place. It was the birthplace of Mormonism, Seventh-day Adventism. It was the birthplace of the women's rights movement. It was where many of Americans' utopian and experimental communities were founded, and it was the birthplace of spiritualism, or this movement that gave itself over to seances and mediums and talking to the dead. I call it the Mount Sinai of American mysticism. It was just an extraordinarily fertile place. The Burned Over District had actually been a homeland to the Iroquois Nation in the days before America was founded. And the Iroquois made a very ill-fated alliance with the British during the War of Independence, and the new American government used that as a pretext to push the Iroquois off that land and open central New York to migration and settlement. And when a swell of relatively liberal New Englanders flowed into central New York State, they had left behind their traditions, their community ties, their churches. So any religious radical who was looking for a congregation, anybody who had a new idea, found his or her audience in the Burned Over District. For about 30 years, it was the most extraordinary laboratory of religious innovation that the modern world had ever seen.
Was Lilydale part of that?
Lilydale was part of that. Lilydale is way over west near the city of Buffalo. Lilydale is a spiritualist summer camp community, which is still around today. There's another in Florida, Casadega. Pete, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, Americans used to get away from the big cities and go to these vast, sprawling religious camps. And some of these places were spiritualist camps where people would pitch tents or rent cabins, and they would talk to the dead. They would organize themselves into seances. They would go to metaphysical lectures. And Lilydale was one of those places, and it still exists today.
Yeah, there are a lot of people who still go up there. And
oh, yeah.
It's like a magnet for mediums.
Yes, indeed.
Well, let's go back a little bit to the Mormon Church, because I'm interested by that, especially because looks like we're going to have a Mormon candidate for president this year.
Oh, yeah. Mormonism has lived out a tremendous destiny in this country, and it's growing still. Joseph Smith, the Mormon prophet, I think was a religious genius. I have the deepest respect for Smith and the message that he brought. He grew up in a household with tremendous and overt occult influences. Smith was every bit a son of the Burned Over District. In letters and articles and oral histories, his mother and other members of his household spoke very freely and very openly of their interest in magic, magical charms, forms of second sight or clairvoyance, astrology. In fact, when Smith died, he was wearing around his neck a silver astrological charm with carvings in it that dedicated itself to the planet of Jupiter, a planet that figured very prominently in Smith's horoscope or birth chart. The markings from that silver charm that appeared around Smith's neck were from an occult book from Europe during the Renaissance called Occult Philosophy by a man named Cornelius Agrippa. Those markings were later copied in another British book by an occult writer named Francis Barrett, which was more commonly found in English-speaking households, almost certainly was in the Smith household. And Smith was deeply into Freemasonry when he was a young man. He was widely known in central New York State as somebody who possessed the gift of second sight. He used to use these things called seer stones which he would place into his hat, and looking into his hat with the benefit of these seer stones, he supposedly was able to help people find buried treasure. Buried treasure hunting was a very big deal in central New York State in the early 1900s. Smith later used a pair of seer stones, as he put it, to transcribe the Book of Mormon from these golden plates that were etched with reformed Egyptian hieroglyphs, as he put it. There was an occult quality to Smith's career, Smith's childhood, Smith's household. The Mormon Church is a wonderful institution. It is going to have to come to terms with its origins and with its past. This isn't something to be ashamed of or embarrassed about or to be all hush-hush about. We all come from someplace. Joseph Smith, religious genius that he was, came from the burned-over district. Clairvoyance, astrology, Freemasonry, abilities of second sight, these were things that were a fundamental part of Smith's childhood and that fired his passions.
You say he's a genius. How can somebody be a religious genius?
Well, I think that the vision that appears in Smith's Book of Mormon is just written on an extraordinary epic scale. I don't know where it came from. I can't tell you any more than anyone else can whether this was transcribed from a set of golden plates. But the modesty of his background, the minimal nature of his schooling was such that however it was that he produced this work, it was a work produced on an extraordinary scale. And he lived out his beliefs, I think, with a tremendous amount of dedication, flaw, and sacrifice. And he was able to create this vast new religious movement from the vision that flowed from his pen, wherever it came from. And so, in that sense, I think he was an extraordinary figure.
And I find his connection with the Freemasons to be really interesting.
Absolutely extraordinary. Smith, towards the end of his life, was widely known to be experimenting with and drawing upon rituals and rites from Freemasonry and incorporating them into the Mormon religion. Smith believed that some of the passion plays and the initiatory ceremonies of the Freemasons represented a legitimate thread of connection to the practices and the rites of the Hebrew priests in the days of the tabernacle. So Smith felt that if he could take these rites and practices in the modern world and incorporate them into Mormonism, he would be attaching his new religion to the religion of the ancient Hebrews. And he had a chartered and recognized Freemasonic lodge in his community of Nauvoo, and he was widely recognized towards the end of his life to have an impassioned interest in Masonry. So some of the rites and rituals that exist today in Mormonism, some of them are Freemasonic in nature, at least in their earliest origins.
Yeah, isn't that wild? I find that so interesting.
It's really amazing. And if you go and look at a Mormon temple, you'll find all kinds of symbols that are a leaf out of Freemasonry, like the symbol of the beehive, for example. The temple in Nauvoo had a weather vane at the top that had a square and compass on it. Symbols like the rising sun. These were things that, that Smith had drawn from Freemasonry. There was a tremendous intersection between the two movements in the person of Joseph Smith.
In general, because in your book you talk about many, many of the different leaders and the different religious leaders in this sort of occult movement that was going on in the 19th century, were these in general, and I don't know if you can make a generalization on this, but were these people, were they mystics, were they religious zealots, were they philosophers, were they quirky, or were they just kind of crazy?
You know, I would say they were all of those things, excluding the last. They weren't crazy in the sense that they may have been eccentric, but they were very effective people. They were able to pull together whole movements around themselves. You know, another person who's not widely known who came from the Burned Over District was a young woman named Jemima Wilkinson. She was a spirit medium who, in 1776, she was a young woman, age of 24, lived in Rhode Island. In fall of 1776, she fell into a coma. Her family wrote her off as dead. She arose from the coma to their great surprise and declared that, in fact, she was dead, but she was a new being animated by the divine spirit. She called herself the public universal friend. Today we might call her a channel or a medium or a psychic. And Jemima, under the name of Public Universal Friend, was able to attract a whole movement around her. And this was just a relatively uneducated 24-year-old young woman from Rhode Island. Most Americans and most modern people had never even seen a woman speak in public before, much less deliver a sermon or a homily. So whatever Jemima's supernatural claims about herself, her abilities at drawing a movement around herself was just extraordinary. So these people, yes, they were philosophers, they were mystics, they were radically independent, they were eccentric, but they were tremendously effective. You know, her followers really were, to a very great extent, some of the responsible for settling Central New York State. They were some of the first white settlers in Central New York State. So the growth of our country, to some extent, is built on some of these breakaway and supernatural religious movements.
Just out of curiosity, now I know because I used to have a good friend of mine who was a Quaker, and they used to call themselves the Friends. Is that related?
Yes. Yes, she did grow up in a Quaker household. Religions love to clip and paste from one another. There's not a religious movement in the world that doesn't borrow from some other movement. Yeah. So Jemima, even though she was claiming to be this supernatural medium, yes, Public Universal Friend, she was drawing the term friend from her Quaker roots and background.
Oh, isn't that interesting? Well, I think during that whole period of time, the role of women just became very important. And out of this sort of interesting occultism, and do you think it's related? Maybe I should ask you this after we come back from the break. But I'm interested to know if you think there is a relationship between the fact that women tend to be, again, this is a generalization, in society much more tuned into the occult. You find more female mediums and psychics
yes.
than you do male. And if that had something to do with their rise during this movement. But let me answer that when we come back. You're listening to Hot Leads Cold Cases, and my guest tonight is Mitch Horowitz.
These girls know how to dish.
To cook, then join us every Wednesday at 5 p.m. Eastern for No Chefs Allowed, a weekly radio show hosted by me, Megan O'Connor, and my sister, best friend, and competitor, Trisha Keel.
Each week, we invite you into the kitchen where we work with one ingredient at a time, turning the unknown into a staple.
Ever hear of a pink peppercorn or a razor clam? Well, you will on this show.
By focusing on one ingredient at a time, you'll learn that some ingredients are easy to work with and become staples, and others you'll just never want to visit again. But they're all conversation starters, and you can join the conversation at No Chefs Allowed.
Want to turn up the heat? Then join us in the No Chefs Allowed Monthly Ingredient Challenge. We give ourselves a whole month to get to know a single ingredient. Check it out on NoChefsAllowed.com or on Facebook.
No Chefs Allowed. Expand your confidence in the kitchen one ingredient at a time.
Figuring which club is sneaking. Fancy drinks and $50 cover charge. Lately it's been a big hassle. Heineken to Newcastle. So make sure he's fitting in and living large. Disregard the lies that he will tell him what his father like. Cause it's not hard. His charm is gonna get him through the night. If he wants to rock, you rock. If he wants to roll, you roll. He can roll with the punches as long as he feels like he's in control. If he wants to stay, he stays. If he wants to go, he goes. He doesn't care how he gets there, long as he gets somewhere he knows. Oh no, na 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 na. See her, heavy makeup and cut t-shirt. Every girl out wants to be her. But they look the same already, why you judge? Reading the magazine secrets, forgetting the topical regrets. If she comes home all alone, the night's a bust, it's a must. Swivel at her hips and the look she gives, it's all a trust. If only in the morning she knew where she lived. Cause if she wants to rock, she rocks. If she wants to roll, she rolls. She can roll with the punch as long as she feels like she's in control. If she wants to stay, she stays. If she wants to go, she goes.
She doesn't care how she gets there, long as she gets somewhere she knows I'll know. Na 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 na. And in a wink, they're on the brink, drink to drink, and at the bar we catch the flow, shot to shot, it's getting hot, advance the plot to see how far it's gonna go, all the pens, so dip the friends and grab a gap, another chance, cheap romance, doesn't count till the room is spinning, nothing to lose, and they both are winning, and they fall in love as they fall in bed, they sing, if they wanna rock, they rock, if they wanna roll, they roll. They can roll with the punches as long as they feel like they're in control. If they want to stay, stay. If they want to go, they go. They don't care how they get there, long as they get somewhere they know, oh no. And na 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 na.
CBS Radio's The New Sky. The Sky.
We're back. This is Hot Leads and Cold Cases with Nancy Duterte. Call Nancy Duterte now.
248-545-7685.
Let's see, we are back. You're listening to Hot Leads Cold Cases. And we are speaking with my guest tonight, Mitch Horowitz, about his book, Occult America. And it's really a fascinating sort of journey that we as Americans have gone through, particularly through the 19th and 20th centuries, to get to where we are today. And what I wanted to talk to you about, Mitch, was how women sort of rose in a way that they never did, because you go back to the mid-19th century, and I know because I'm also a lawyer, that they didn't have, they were considered chattel, and they certainly didn't have voting rights.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, women are becoming leaders of these fairly important spiritual movements. How'd that happen?
You know, the fact is, and this is an aspect of our history that we have not come to terms with, and most historical writers don't even recognize it, the door to the women's rights movement, to a very great extent, was opened by the movement of spiritualism. Both the suffragist movement and the spiritualist movement grew up in the same neighborhood, just a few miles down the road from one another, on what is today U.S. Route 20 in central New York State in the Burned-Over District. It started, really, in 1848. When the spiritualist movement basically began in a little log cabin outside of Rochester, New York, which was home to a Methodist family called the Fox family. And two young teenage girls in that family, Kate and Margaret, told their parents that the bangs and the raps and the noises that were being heard throughout their cabin that winter were actually spirit raps. And the two young girls, Kate and Margaret, told their parents that they had worked out a method to actually communicate with beings from the other world through these raps. So all kinds of people, clergy and scientists and newspaper reporters, descended on the cabin, and many of them came away and said, you know what, Kate and Margaret are telling the truth. And thus was born the movement that we call spiritualism. And Americans started organizing themselves into seance circles, and there were mediums and seance clubs and parlors and newspapers. Several months later, down the road, was the first conference for women's rights in Seneca Falls, New York, and there was an enormous overlap at that time and for about a generation afterward between suffragist activists and spirit mediums, because spiritualism was actually the first movement, the first modern religious movement that gave women a regular and visible role as leaders. Most of the mediums were women. Most of the people presiding over the seance table, giving talks at metaphysical societies, were women. And any ambitious, forward-looking woman who wanted to have a voice in the religious and social culture for a period of time got attracted to spiritualism. Becoming a medium, although it seems hard to imagine today in the 21st century, was one of the first and few jobs, opportunities, public roles that was available to a woman. Mm-hmm. A woman could be a homemaker, a woman perhaps could be a school teacher or a maid. Maybe there were a few opportunities to be an actress or some kind of a stage performer, very few. But suddenly, everyday folks, and spiritualism was very much a movement of everyday people, could sit at the seance table and assume the role of prophet. And we haven't really made that connection. There are some historians, Anne Broad is one of them, and her work is wonderful, who have made the connection. But this is a piece of our history that hasn't been written. There is a tremendous overlap between the spiritualist movement, this occult movement that grew up in central New York in the mid-19th century, and the women's rights movement, which grew up in the same neighborhood. And that the tie between those movements was quite pronounced and clear for about a generation in the 19th century.
Well, there's also another really interesting tie, or potential tie. I mean, you tell me if it was really there. But the wife of President Lincoln, Mary Todd Lincoln,
that's right,
is a spiritist.
That's right.
Spiritualist, I suppose.
That's right.
Because spiritists are the ones down in South America. But she would hold seances, from what I understand, in the White House.
And that's right.
Presumably, she had some influence on the whole anti-slavery movement.
That's right. You know, Mary Todd Lincoln, Lincoln's wife, was a committed spiritualist, and it was a focus and a fascination for her for much of her life. And she came to the movement for the same reason that many other people did. She was seeking solace from the grief of having lost children. Later, she was seeking solace from the grief of having lost her husband. And there is evidence, and I went over this with great care, and I write about it in Occult America, that there was at least one and probably two seances that were held in the Lincoln White House with President Lincoln present both times. And at one seance, there was a trance medium who told Lincoln that the spirits wanted him to sign the Emancipation Proclamation, that if he did so, that would be the great thing for which he would be remembered. Now, today, as 21st century people, we kind of look back on that and smile, but it says something important, which is that spiritualists wanted to be seen as being on the progressive side of things. The spiritualist movement not only intersected with the suffragist movement, but it was into abolitionism, it was against capital punishment, it was into temperance, which at one time was considered a very progressive cause. Avant-garde religion and avant-garde politics grew up hand-in-hand in America. So the fact that a spirit medium would be telling Lincoln, go ahead and sign the Emancipation Proclamation, is actually a very important historical note, because it tells you what the political outlook of spiritualism was. These weren't just apolitical folks who liked talking to spirits. These were people who thought that they were giving shape to a new universal religion that recognized and valued all people. When people sat at the seance table and talked to beings that they thought were in heaven or from the afterworld, they were talking to people from all races and religions, which also had a very important social overtone. It was the idea that salvation could be available to all people, not just one group or tribe or members of one doctrine. So the spiritualist movement, to really understand it, one has to understand that it was also a progressive movement.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Let's see. I wanted to ask you, and I've got to switch gears just a little bit because we're going to run out of time otherwise, but you put together a fabulous video about the Ouija board and mm-hmm. the history of the Ouija board. And I know a lot of people have a lot of ideas about it, such as the only thing I ever really knew was, you know, the origins with Parker Brother and
yeah.
then the fact that it was, you know, we and ya, French and German for yes, maybe, and maybe some Egyptian heritage, but that was always kind of unclear. But maybe you could just tell us just a little bit about it, because a lot of people
sure.
want to know.
The Ouija board is actually an object that comes out of the age of spiritualism. In fact, it's probably the one widely recognized surviving object that comes out of that era. Americans always operated on a do-it-yourself spirit. They always wanted to figure out, how can I do it easier? How can I do it faster? How can I do it better? And they brought that way of thinking to the seance table. They brought that way of thinking to the practice of talking to the dead. And so as Americans in the latter part of the 1800s were searching for new methods that would make the seance easier, that would make this experience more accessible, they came up with something that was called the alphabet board. Later it was called the talking board. And in the 1880s, you start to see articles in newspapers about spiritualists in Ohio using this thing called a talking board. And when you look at the pictures, it's the very spitting image of what we know as the Ouija board. It was a few years later that a group of toy manufacturers in the city of Baltimore managed to patent this talking board. They called it Ouija. They started marketing it as a toy, as a novelty, around 1891, and it just spread across the whole country to the point where later in the 20th century it actually outsold the game of Monopoly, which had been the most popular board game in the country up till that time. So Ouija boards, we think of them as a toy, we think of them as some dangerous, distracting object, but what they really are is an occult device that came out of the age of spiritualism.
Well, they're very similar to automatic writing.
Yes, indeed. And they grew out of that. You know, Americans were experimenting with all kinds of methods of talking to the dead, and the little plank that revolves around the Ouija board, which is called the planchette, was modeled after an earlier object into which you would insert a pencil, rest your hands on it, and that was a method of automatic writing. But Americans dispensed with the pencil, and they found an easier way to do it, as we always seem to find, and that led to the development of that little platform that moves around the board.
Well, I have to ask you, have you ever used one?
Oh, yes. In fact, this video that you mentioned, we used one in the video. I've used one. I can't quite tell you what the kinetic force is that moves that little platform around. Everybody's sitting there, very self-aware. Nobody's apparently moving it. Why is it moving? It's kind of strange. But, yeah, I have tried.
Well, so then that's my question. What do you think moved it?
I really don't know. You know, I mean, the materialist explanation is that the individuals are moving it themselves and that they're spelling out unconscious messages from their own mind. That's not much more reassuring than the supernatural explanation, because if a lot of people have very negative, scary stories about Ouija boards, and if we're moving the platform ourselves, it makes me wonder, you know, what's hiding within the folds of our own minds. So either the materialist or the supernatural explanation is not very reassuring.
So, but what do you think?
That's a good question. I think there is some other faculty out there that's moving it. I don't know whether it's clairvoyant. I don't know whether it's supernatural. I guess I would have to declare myself in question about it. I'm absolutely unwilling to write off the possibility that there is some supernatural element that is moving the planchette. I refuse to rule out questions of the supernatural, and I think historians make a mistake when they try to probe why a movement like spiritualism is popular, and they consider all the social questions, which are well worth considering, but they don't even stop to nod to the possibility that maybe these movements are popular because people are experiencing something real.
Yeah, I mean, for me personally, I won't touch a Ouija board. I find them to be unbelievable.
I hear that from a lot of people. And I would say, you know, one doesn't have to abandon critical thinking or a critical view of the world to at least consider the question, at least just pause over the question that there is the possibility of an authentic experience when we're approaching the mainstream faith, Judaism, Catholicism, what have you. Historians are willing to sort of respectfully bow out of the question of belief or disbelief. They won't summarily reject the possibility that somebody is experiencing something of a higher principle when they're engaged in Catholic Mass, for example. I simply think we have to be willing to bring the same acknowledgement to the supernatural experience.
Yeah, good for you. We've got to.
Are you looking for a great gift idea for someone interested in the paranormal? Then listen up, because we've got the perfect solution for you. Author and psychic detective Nancy Dutetra has just published a groundbreaking new book entitled Psychic Intuition. This book is unlike any other on the market today. It explains how psychic ability works in simple scientific and layman's terms and uses examples from Nancy's own life as a psychic detective and medium. The book explores all those thorny questions skeptics always ask and no one ever has an answer for. Like, why are women more intuitive than men? Is there such a thing as a sixth sense? Are psychics really just psychotic? How do psychic detectives get their information? What does it feel like to be touched by a ghost? What are the psychic senses and how do they work? Why won't science investigate this field? The book answers these and many more questions. Psychic Intuition is available on Amazon in paperback and Kindle format, and also on Nancy's website, www.theskepticalpsychic.com. Buy it today.
when I gave your word. Now in the morning I sleep alone, sweep the streets I used to own.
Radio's The New Sky. New horizons, no boundaries.
Back to hot leads and cold cases with Nancy Duterte.
You're hot and you're cold. Yes and you're no. You're in and you're out. You're up and you're down.
Call Nancy Duterte now.
248-545-SOUL.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Hot Leads, Cold Cases. And before the break, I was speaking with my guest, Mitch Horowitz, about the various developments of the Ouija board. And there are about a million different ways that we could talk about the Ouija board. But I have one question that I got to ask you, just because I think it's kind of strange.
Sure.
And that is that this game was first marketed in, I guess it was 1890, by a couple of Baltimore businessmen, and then 2 years later by this young kid. He was 19. He was a former employee of the dissolved company.
Mm-hmm.
And strangely enough, and he's the guy who sort of makes it massively popular, his name was Fuld.
Yes.
He dies at the age of 56 when he fell three stories off the top of his factory building.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you think that that's a funny ending for a guy who spent his life building the Ouija board?
Stranger still is that Fuld said he was no spiritualist. He was a Presbyterian. He disavowed any interest in the board. The board made William Fuld a millionaire, truly a millionaire, in an era where millionaires were not common to come by. It also caused a tremendous fissure in his family. His brother Isaac made a competing board that was found to have violated William's contract, and William and Isaac went into a long stretch of patent litigation. The two brothers never spoke again, and although Fuld became a very wealthy man off of the Ouija board, he died a very tragic and painful death, falling three stories backwards while he was supervising the installation of a flagpole outside of his Baltimore factory. So the Ouija board did not bring happiness or success in any true sense, to the Fold family.
Okay, just wanted to get that clear.
Yeah.
Also, another thing that I find really interesting, and unfortunately we don't have time to really go into all of the 20th century historical aspects of occultism, but you touched on them sort of briefly with New Thought, the power of positive thinking,
mm-hmm.
I guess Frank Robinson, the first mail order prophet, Dale Carnegie,
yeah.
Norman Vincent Peale with positive thinking, and
yeah.
even the law of attraction, which
has
been around for a long time.
The law of attraction was actually a phrase used by a spirit medium from the Hudson Valley in New York called Andrew Jackson Davis. He used the term in 1855, and the way he originally used it was intended to mean that the character and the personality of people at a seance table would dictate the kind of spirits they would attract. Later, it was remade as a law of prosperity, but it was originally a law thought to govern what went on at the seance table.
Oh, interesting. Because, I mean, obviously since the writing of the Secret and that kind of work, I mean, everybody seems to know what the law of attraction is right now.
Right. It's a word on everybody's lips, but it actually has its roots in the writings of an occult medium from 1855 in this country.
Yeah. The other thing that I thought was very interesting is that in the 20th century, you have occultism sort of being used politically by diametrically opposed political groups, such as you had it apparently being used by Hitler and the Nazis, and then you also had it being used by Gandhi as a Hindu trying to put together India's independence movement.
Gandhi said that occult ideas, specifically ideas coming from the movement called Theosophy, which was co-founded by a Russian occultist named Madame H.P. Blavatsky, Gandhi said that those ideas gave him his first taste of the principle of religious universality. Nobody ever talks about the occult influence on Gandhi, but of course, you know, you flick on cable television and every 15 minutes you find a documentary on Hitler and the occult. I actually think the occult connection to Hitler has been overstated, but it titillates people, so they keep returning to it. But the occult connection to Gandhi and the very forthright way that he explained how he derived some of his early ideas from Madame Blavatsky and the Theosophical movement, that's a connection that we haven't fully understood in modern life.
Yeah, it's kind of bizarre and fascinating. But then also, equally bizarre, I guess, with Hitler, he banned astrology in Nazi Germany.
Absolutely. Freemasons, astrologers, occultists, they were persecuted and sent to concentration camps under Hitler. People, I think, don't understand that Hitler would glom on to symbols and signs and sigils, and he would use these things because they have a certain mass appeal, like the image of the swastika, and he would completely discard the people and the ideas behind these things. Hitler was not an occultist. He pirated occult images and just as soon would send Freemasons and astrologers to their death in concentration camps as he would borrow some of their mythical images.
Well, they've been burning witches for as long as we know. So.
Unfortunately, yeah.
We have about another couple of minutes left in the show, and I'm curious what you think about, I mean, today the occult movement, if you want to call it that, is really not very political.
It's not political because the occult movement has spread out all across our country. On a Sunday morning, when you see even an evangelical figure like Joel Osteen giving a sermon on the benefits of motivational thinking, he is standing on the shoulders of a mystical philosophy that grew up in this country. You find language about motivational thinking, both on the New Age culture and within the world of evangelical megachurches, that is very, very closely related language. We don't see the occult because it's all around us. Every time somebody gets reimbursed for an acupuncture treatment or a chiropractic treatment by their insurance company, every time somebody participates in an alternative health program or goes to lunchtime yoga from their job, they are stepping through a door that was opened by occult and alternative religious movements in America. When movements succeed in America, they seem to be they're everywhere. They're remade by everybody. And the movement itself, its outer wrapping, gets forgotten. But that's often what success of an idea looks like in America.
Yeah, absolutely. We, unfortunately, are out of time. Mitch, I just want to make sure that everybody knows where they can contact you if they'd like to reach you. And also, you have an upcoming event at the Edgar Cayce Foundation's annual Ancient Mysteries Conference in Virginia Beach, I believe.
That's right. I'll be speaking at the Edgar Cayce Foundation in Virginia Beach the weekend of May 18th at the Ancient Mysteries Conference, one of my favorite events. Anybody who wants to find me can go to my website, which is mitchhorowitz.com.
Terrific. Thank you so much. Really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.